Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. We are continuing our series of interviews with political candidates vying for high office. And tonight, we speak to former nonprofit executive John Barron. The Democrat is running for governor in Maryland and vows to bring change to state education and health care. Lines are open if you have a comment or a question for John Barron at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. Barron, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Harold, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Sure thing. So let us first, as we ask all candidates, we'd like to give you the microphone for a minute and share with our listeners who John Barron is and why he should be governor.
Okay. Well, so I am a longtime Maryland resident. I've lived here 28 years, spent most of my childhood here. I actually went to the same public schools my kids went to, and I live about 2 miles down the street in Montgomery County from the house where I grew up. Career-wise, I'm a former nonprofit executive. Before that, I headed a billion-dollar technology program in the Clinton administration. I've been an appointee of Democratic and Republican presidents. I've gotten major federal legislation enacted into law that's benefited Maryland and other states. So the reason I'm running for governor is that Maryland isn't making progress on major problems that damage millions of lives, and I'm offering a fundamentally different approach. In education, for instance, more than a quarter of middle school students in our state can't read at a basic level. Those numbers are no different than 20 years ago. Moderate-income Marylanders have seen flat wages since the 1980s, as income inequality has soared. And our state has made no progress reducing our poverty rate in more than 30 years. We can't just keep doing the same thing we've been doing for decades, rolling out one unproven government program after another and expect a different result, because unfortunately, many programs, no matter how well-meaning they are, they just don't work. So to make progress, we need to expand solutions that don't just sound like good ideas, but have actually been tested in the real world and shown to make a big difference in people's lives. I'll give you one quick example, one concrete example. When I'm governor, we will provide high-quality tutoring to every struggling first and second grader in the entire state of Maryland, because that's been shown to move them up toward grade level early before the problems get serious in later grades. And we're going to do this by recruiting an army of people from the community, including retirees and recent college graduates, to become tutors for a modest stipend as a public service. That's just one example of a proven solution that I'll bring to Maryland. I'd love to share others as well.
How would you specifically address the more broader issues regarding education? Some would argue that just throwing money at it is not it.
I agree with that point entirely. In fact, you know, Maryland has seen flat education numbers, not just in reading, but in math. That, you know, a third of kids in middle school can't do basic math. No change for 20 years. Even though during the 2000s, Maryland saw a big rise in education spending, about a 40% increase per pupil adjusted for inflation. The reason that did not work, that it didn't translate into improved student outcomes, is because, again, a lot of programs, education programs, teacher training programs, and all the rest, they don't work. So what we need to do, very different, and I support the blueprints, I support additional funding for education, but to make progress, that funding needs to be focused on solutions that actually, you know, are tested and shown to work. I gave the tutoring example. One other example is career academies in high-poverty high schools. Those are small learning communities with a career theme like engineering or law and links with local employers who provide internships. They've been shown to increase long-term earnings of young adults by $3,000 per person, including for kids that go on to college and those who don't. That's it. So long story short, it's not just a matter of spending money on well-intentioned programs. We need to focus the money on tested and proven solutions like the ones I've described if we're going to make progress.
We're talking to John Barron. He is a Democrat running for governor in the state of Maryland. If you have a comment or a question for him, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Lines, of course, are open all the way up until about 8 o'clock. I will tell you, I saw your campaign commercial earlier this week. I must say it is clever. The bike riding with Natalie Williams. It got my attention. I thought it was very clever and actually kind of funny. But what is the message in that commercial, in that political ad? Where else do you think that Maryland is just spinning its wheels?
Well, thank you for mentioning that and for watching the ad and paying attention. I do want to mention Natalie Williams is my running mate. She is a fantastic partner in this effort. She'll make a wonderful lieutenant governor. She's a very accomplished political leader, communications professional, healthcare advocate, and mom. And we've got a new commercial out. She's going to be featured prominently in that one, too. We are partners in this effort. So I mentioned education is one area where we're not making progress. And in the commercial, it shows us on a bicycle. It's a tandem bike. And initially, we're in front of a green screen, and the camera pulls back, and we're just riding but getting nowhere. We're in place. The message is, we're not getting anywhere. You know, we're trying all these things. We're not getting anywhere. We need to do tested and proven solutions. One area, other area where we're not making progress is the fact that the bottom 40% of Marylanders have seen flat wages since about 1980, while income inequality has soared. If you told us, 40 years ago that this would happen, the American narrative of optimism and progress, the idea that each generation would do better than the last, that no longer applies to almost half of our people. That's not just true in Maryland. It's true across the country. But there are solutions to that. One of my main initiatives in the first 100 days in office would be to partner with businesses across the state to provide effective job training to every young adult in the state of Maryland who wants to advance. If it's done right, job training has been shown to increase earnings as much as 40%, which is a huge benefit. But the key is to focus the training on fast-growing industries. That's number one, like IT or healthcare. And number two, to work hand-in-hand with businesses who provide paid internships to the trainees. So under our plan, the state will pay for the training, the businesses pay for the internships, our economy gets skilled workers. Everyone benefits from that.
One of the things that has been a big concern in the state, as you know, is crime. Baltimore City has been really struggling with it. I know I live in Baltimore, and there has been a lot of back and forth between City Hall and the State House. Where do you come down on dealing with crime in Baltimore City? What role do you believe the governor should play in helping Baltimore deal with that issue?
Well, Baltimore, as you know, I didn't realize that you lived there, but so this is...
It's a long commute and gas is high, but that's another issue.
Maybe we can discuss that as well.
I've got that for you, but go ahead.
All right. Very good. Baltimore, as you know, has had over 300 homicides a year for 7 years in a row. That's as bad as it was during the crime wave of the 1990s. And Baltimore ranks up with St. Louis and Detroit as having the highest homicide rate in the country for a major city. It's a matter of quality of life. People should be still safe going about their daily activities. And in some cases, it's a matter of life and death. And Baltimore will never recover economically or population-wise until the crime issue is successfully addressed. So here's what I would do. I've laid out a number of proposals on my website, but one of the main initiatives, we would partner as governor. My administration will partner with Baltimore City officials, including the police officials, to bring to Baltimore a highly effective crime-fighting approach called focused deterrence. It's an approach that recognizes that most violent crime is actually committed by a relatively small number of individuals who are repeat violent offenders. These individuals are invited in for meetings with community leaders and social service agencies and law enforcement. They are offered a positive way forward, like job opportunities and counseling. But the meetings also make clear that if they continue to act violently, they will be the focus of extraordinary attention from law enforcement. So there's a positive way forward, but there's also a strong enforcement component. This approach has been found very effective in other cities. In Oakland, California, for instance, it helped reduce the homicide rate over a five-year period by about 50%. There's receptiveness to the approach by Police Chief Harrison and others in Baltimore, and my administration would be a full partner in making sure it's successful.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to John Barron. He's a Democrat running for governor in Maryland and vows to bring educational and health care change to the state. If you have any comments or questions, now is the time to give us a call. Lines are open. You talk about health care. What's wrong with health care in the state of Maryland, and what impact would you have on it as governor?
Well, healthcare, thanks to Obamacare, more Marylanders are covered by health insurance now. It's, 93% are covered. So we've made a lot, 94% are covered. So we've made a lot of progress in that area, which is all to the good. But the big problem for most families is that out-of-pocket medical expenses for a typical Maryland household are 50% higher than they were 10 years ago after you adjust for inflation. Healthcare costs just keep rising and rising and rising for scripts and drug costs, costs of insulin and others, eating into household budgets, state government budgets, and others. It's so I would bring innovations in healthcare delivery that have been tested and shown to improve health and to reduce costs. I'll give you one example. There's a program that was developed in Los Angeles that pairs black barbershops with pharmacists. So when men come in to get their hair cut, they get screened for high blood pressure, and if needed, they get medication. It was shown to reduce the rate of uncontrolled high blood pressure, which is a leading killer of black men, by more than half. It also saves a lot of money, because if you can prevent high blood pressure and all the downstream, the effects of that, like heart disease and kidney failure and stroke and all of that, you prevent an enormous healthcare burden, a cost burden to the patient and for others. This is a common sense solution. It meets people where they are. It is not a high cost thing to do. We should be doing it throughout the state of Maryland. That's just one example of a proven solution in the area of healthcare that I bring.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to John Barron. He's a former nonprofit executive. He's a Democrat running for governor in Maryland, vowing to bring change to the state, particularly as it relates to education and health care. This is part of our ongoing series interviewing political candidates who are vying for high office. We've got Ms. Jones on the line. She's calling from Silver Spring. Also, we have Andre calling from Maryland. We are going to be taking your calls in just a bit, so please do not hang up. You're going to be right up after the break. Don't hang up. You will be able to hear the program, so please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. And of course, don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com, or download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. Hang on, we'll be back on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are continuing our series of interviews with political candidates vying for office. Tonight we are talking to Maryland gubernatorial candidate John Barron. He's a Democrat. If you have a comment or if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's talk to Ms. Jones calling from Silver Spring. Ms. Jones, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, good evening. Yes, back in 2019, my property taxes went up considerably, and the justification for that was given that the Purple Line was being built here in the Langley Park in Montgomery County. And the construction began on the Purple Line project, but when COVID hit, it seemed like we didn't see any of the guys out there working anymore. And we haven't seen it since then. There's been no advancement on that project. I was just wondering if you could give us an insight of if you have any knowledge of when that project will be finished or what's going on with the project.
Mr. Barron. Well,
yes, Ms. Jones, thanks for that question. The Purple Line, boy, you're really touching on a big issue here. The Purple Line is over $1.5 billion. That's B with a B. $1 billion over budget.
Wow.
And 4 years behind mm-hmm. schedule. It is just it has turned into a fiasco. One of the problems, one of the reasons that occurred, was because one of the contractors for the Purple Line, a Texas-based company called Fluor, had a long history of underbidding big government procurement projects like this around the country, and then leaving the taxpayers holding the bill. And they've been sued in court and so on. We knew that. We knew that at the time that we were making the award here. Here's what I would do differently. I do support completion of the Purple Line, but it is extremely important to choose a contractor for this and other big infrastructure projects like this around the state who has a track record of completing large infrastructure projects on time and within budget. When I was at the Pentagon, I headed a billion-dollar procurement program, and we implemented a number of reforms that did exactly that, and we won awards for it, looking more at past performance, not just what somebody writes on a piece of paper and a proposal to the government about what they're planning to do. That's important. But equally important, maybe even more important, is looking whether the contractor you select has a long history of being able to complete these projects and do it within budget. So we did it wrong on the Purple Line, and we should do it right going forward, and that's what I would do as governor.
Ms. Jones, thank you so much for your phone call.
Thank you.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking to John Barron. He's running for governor in Maryland. He's a Democrat. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Let us go to Andre calling from Maryland. Andre, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I was calling because he's speaking on the issue of tutoring kids and outreach program. Well, if it's not being enforced at home, how do you get over that hurdle?
I'm sorry, I missed it.
Yeah, he said if he was talking about tutoring at home and the importance of it, but he said if education is not being enforced or supported at home, how do you get over that hurdle? How do you win hearts and minds? And let me not put words in your mouth, Andre, but let me know how I'm doing here. How do you win hearts and minds of parents who may not be supportive for whatever reason of their child's education?
Or have educational issues themselves. And
if
you can't get the parents, you know, if the parents is not up to a par on education, how can you kind of get between the part of not being at home and being tutored and then getting home and following through and keeping them on the same page?
Yeah, that's a really important question. Mr. Barron?
Well, Andre, that's a wonderful question. I was lucky in my life. My mother was a reading teacher. She taught kids with reading disabilities in the public school. And when I was growing up, and I have four siblings, she taught all of us. She took time out of the workforce. She taught all of us to read in kindergarten.
Andre. Let him answer your question. Go ahead, Mr. Barron.
Yeah, so when we got to first grade, we all thought we were geniuses. Every child should feel like that, whether they have a mother or father who's a, you know, who can provide that kind of attention or not. That is a role that a tutor can play. It's a caring adult from the community who has been trained in how to teach reading. And it's not just the instruction. It's a person who is there to be effective in the child's life and serves as a partner. To be effective, tutoring really has to be done, and this is how we would do it if I'm elected. It has to be done 5 days a week for the struggling student, about 20 to 30 minutes a day. And again, it has to be done by a trained person from the community. And that is an additional adult in the community, in the child's life, who could make a real difference.
So how do you, but his question is, how do you provide support for parents who need to deal with the trickle-down effect of getting their children the help that they need? I think his question is, if parents need help getting the message, if parents need help encouraging their children, and for whatever reason they are unable to, is that a role that the state can play? Is it something that they have to allow to first be, you know, deployed to the individual school systems? What's the strategy for that?
Well, that's yes. We need to try. The short answer is yes. We should be doing parent training and parent assistance. But again, it needs to be focused on effective approaches, because there are many well-meaning programs out there that don't actually help the parent or the child. But let me talk about one that does. And we worked very closely initially with the Bush administration and the Obama administration to scale this up. It's now a $400 million program. It's for women who are very much at risk. It's for women who are pregnant with their first child, low income, and single. These are women with very few resources. Many of them are teenagers, and they're about to have a child. And a nurse visits them during their pregnancy in the first 2 years of their child's life and teaches them basic parenting skills, how to talk to their kid, how to read to the child, during pregnancy, not to smoke, not to drink, how to practice effective birth control so she doesn't immediately have another closely spaced birth. This program has been shown. It's the kind of thing you're talking about. It provides effective support to the parent, and it's been shown, consistent with your question, to improve the educational outcomes of the children throughout elementary school and beyond. So it also reduces the rate of child abuse substantially. But that's the kind of effective support that we need.
Who pays for that?
Well, what I was trying to get through is saying, if the parent education is not up to par or standard, how can you support the kid? How can the kid be furthered at home to stay on board of what they're receiving when they're not at home? Now, if you got a parent that's working or can't be there for the kid, now, they always say it starts from the root, and that would be more needed focused on the home, because I think it would be mostly a loss if you can't get the parent, you know, involved in it, and not just only the parent, the community. You keep going, because some people, like, it's not as fortunate as you. Like you said, you had your parent read to you. Some parents can't read. Some, you know, so how do you get around that? So with the whole program will become a loss, because, you, like you said, you got to start from the root, and it always starts from the parent.
Well, there are things we can do to make it easier for the parents. Let me give you one example of a solution that is quite effective. Now, it won't work for everybody, but for a lot of parents are very busy. They're working. I was lucky, as I mentioned, very lucky to have a mother who was able, had the time to do this, wasn't working a second job and all the rest. So others, the families are very busy. A lot is going on. They're trying to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. There is, in addition to tutoring, where the tutor incidentally can work with the teacher and with the family, by the way, to reinforce the help that the child is getting at school. So it's more of a partnership. But there's another thing that can be done, which is there's an approach that this one also was tested in Los Angeles, where if a child, sometimes the kid doesn't show up at school. Sometimes they show up late at school. Sometimes they don't hand in assignments. Sometimes they're having real trouble in a particular class. This program puts in a call or a text to the parent to let them know that it is going on. So the parent is aware of the problem and can do whatever, because a lot of times with so much going on, they may not be aware of exactly, you know, the whereabouts of their child or the problems that they may be having. So we need to do effective strategies like this that make it easy for them to identify what's going on and to help their child and make sure, among other things, that they complete the homework assignment.
Yeah. Andre, thank you so much for your thoughtful and penetrating question. I appreciate it. I did want to follow up with what Andre was saying about who would pay for a program, as you said. The idea of that parenting support for single mothers and the like, and kind of bringing the education component there, but it also sounds expensive, and certainly as it relates to taxes, the disrespectfully high cost of living, particularly in the border states, border counties, a lot of people would be a bit reticent to once again see the possibility of taxes going up.
Yes. Well, for the let me mention a couple things. Tutoring, to mention that example, can be done relatively inexpensively if you use people from the community who are paid a modest stipend. So to tutor every child in the state who is struggling in first and second grade would cost about $200 million a year. That's not nothing, but in the context of the state education budget and even the planned increases, that is a very modest cost. It's just a fraction of the increase that's proposed, and it would make a major difference. Now, in terms of parenting programs, there is federal money available. There's $400 million a year nationally. It's about $15 million a year, I believe, in Maryland that is available that could be focused on strategies like that, on programs like the nurse visitation program that I described. In addition, some of these programs, they are costly, whether they're paid for with federal funds or others, but they also have offsetting benefits, offsetting cost reductions. For example, this nurse program was shown to reduce the mother's use of public assistance, welfare, Medicaid, and other services. They don't need it as much. They're more self-sufficient. They get back into the workforce more quickly, and to pay for itself over time, roughly a 20-year period.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk a little bit about politics, literal and geographical. I suspect that you may have seen the article in the Washington Post on yesterday saying that Prince George's County is no longer the wealthiest majority black county in America, and that has shifted to Charles County. To what do you attribute that shift, and what do you think about it?
Well, I think whether it's in Prince George's County or elsewhere, we need it is a part of a larger problem that we are not the most important factor in the economic success of any jurisdiction, whether it's Prince George's County or the state of Maryland or any other state, is whether we have a workforce that is well-trained, well-educated, highly skilled. That factor matters to economic success more than the things that, you know, politicians are debating endlessly, like the corporate tax rate and all the rest. People matter. The quality of the workforce matters. It really matters to economic success. That's why my agenda as governor is so focused on things like effective job training, partnering with businesses to, you know, provide effective job training that increases earnings, $8,000 a year, career academies, as I described, and high poverty high schools that have been shown to give people a leg up. This is the area where we are not succeeding, especially for kids who don't go on to college. Most kids don't go on to college. We need to give them and others the skills they need to succeed in the workforce and make it into the middle class.
Let's talk about the Goucher College poll. Year after year, it seems to be a bit of a bellwether to determine this moment in time when it comes to elections, big and small. And right now, you're polling at about 2% behind Peter Franchot at 16%, and I'm talking just for the Democrats, 14% for Wes Moore, Tom Perez, 14%, and Doug Gansler, 4%. Doug Gansler, 5%, John King, 4%, and of course, you, 2%, Ashwani Jain, 2%. It suggests that you have some work to do. How do you get outside of clever political ads? The primary is next month. How are you going to make a dent, or is that something that you're just not concerned about?
Oh no, I'm very focused on it. I plan to win the primary. One of the things in that poll that you just described is that 35% of voters are undecided, and over 60% said that they could change their vote. They're open to changing their vote. So by all accounts, in this poll, other polls, all the pundits, this is a completely fluid situation, and it is a scenario where a new face with a compelling message can break through against traditional politicians, with all of these candidates splitting the vote. Now, I am not a household name. I mean, I don't have a lot of a name recognition compared to the other candidates like Peter Franchot and the others. But that changed because our ads, the poll went into the field at the same time, the Goucher poll, at the same time, roughly the same day that our ads started. And we have money to get our message out on the airwaves. We're doing it in a very robust way. So I think when people hear the message and they get to know me and the message, and it, I think it's a very compelling message, you can judge for yourself, they're going to move in our direction. Let me mention one other thing. All of the candidates share similar goals. We all want to improve education and, wages and all the rest. But my message is very different from that of the other candidates. What they are proposing is to roll out the same thing we've been doing for decades, rolling out one unproven government program after another, not recognizing a key point, which is that many government programs, as you said earlier, it's not just a matter of spending money. A lot of government programs just don't work. I mean, they're not recognizing that. Natalie and my approach is very, very different than that. It is focused like a laser beam on solutions that don't just sound good, aren't just spending money, aren't just well-intentioned, but have actually been tested and shown to make a big difference in people's lives. So I think when people hear that compelling message, and they are now, and I appreciate this opportunity to convey the message on your show, but we're getting it out also on the airwaves with a robust media campaign, I'm hopeful. I think I have a real shot at winning the primary.
What do you say to the politicians that for years have complained that, for example, Prince George's County has not gotten its fair share of the fiscal pie from Annapolis, whether that's a perception or whether it's real? It seems that Montgomery County has always gotten a lot more. Now, granted, Montgomery County is the most heavily populated in the state. That could be one of the reasons. But if you don't live in Montgomery County, then you've got, you know, you probably have other counties who are saying, well, what about us? We have issues too.
Yes, well, I think it is absolutely imperative that we have a fair distribution of funding around the state. Now, one area where funds have gone toward, jurisdictions that have a significant need, for instance, is education. So the three counties in Maryland that have the greatest education spending per pupil, and this is largely due to state money from Annapolis, are Baltimore City, Dorchester County, and Somerset County, because they have, and which are also some of have the highest poverty rates and the highest educational needs. As in education and other areas, the need of the community and the relative advantage or disadvantage of the community has to play, as it does to a large extent in education, has to play a central role in how the money gets distributed.
One of the other issues, and again, this is about perception. And I've asked some of the other candidates this, but I'd like to hear your thoughts about it. Who's going to cut the daggone grass in the state? I see a lot of grass because, as I said, I have a 100-mile per day round trip commute, whether it's 295, whether it's 95. Some of my colleagues are concerned about, and the irony is you see all of these political signs in high grass on 301. And there are other places, and I think perception is a reality, you know, particularly when you're driving through. Yeah, people care about schools and stuff like that. Definitely a big issue. But, you know, people are visual, and it just seems, you know, a lot of rain or not, you drive through Maryland, and I'm not talking about, like you said, Dorchester or Somerset or Frederick County where you got amber waves of grain. I'm talking about, you know, nearby. No, you know, you drive through and you're like, what is going on? How do you change that quality of life perception? It's just like in your neighborhood. If the neighbor across the street isn't cutting his or her grass, the neighbors want to go storming the place with pitchforks and torches like Frankenstein's castle.
That's very good. I will tell you, running for governor takes a lot of time and is very stressful. And one of my great releases these days is getting out and mowing my own grass.
I think you're going to be doing all of that.
I don't know. I tell the neighbors if I get elected, I'm still coming back to mow the grass every other week. So, but I agree with you. It's not just a matter of appearances. It's partly that. It's also, it goes to a larger quality of life issue. It goes beyond just appearances. So, I would want to, you know, look into this further in part and figure out, you know, exactly how this is. But I agree with you about the importance of it. And the government, the state government, would need to partner with local jurisdictions to address the problem. But to your point about it going beyond just, you know, the look of whether the grass is high or not, there's some reason to believe, there's some studies that have shown that in whether you have, when you clean up an environment, like there was a program that was implemented in Philadelphia that took vacant lots, which were, you know, decaying and not taken care of and so on. And this was done with the police force and city government, and they cleaned them up and planted trees there and mowed the grass and came back every week and made sure that it was taken care of. And it not only made it a much nicer place to hang out, but it also reduce the crime rate in those areas. This was done in high crime blocks within the city, And so what you're describing could be a very promising approach to improving public safety as well. They not only cleaned up but they also installed lighting at night and all the rest. So but those kind of environmental efforts can make a real difference potentially on public safety as well.
If you were governor now, would you support another gas tax holiday?
So you are getting back to the gas tax.
I said I was going to get to. Yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't forget about it. You know. So.
Okay. Yes, and you're I know your answer to it because you do this long commute from Baltimore.
That's right. Boy, my arms are tired. But
yeah, so I know what you would do if you were governor. So I do. I support a. They're scheduled to go into effect in almost immediately, a cost of living adjustment, a 6 or 7 cent increase in the price of gasoline. It happens every few years to adjust for inflation. They adjust the gas tax. I support delaying that increase until gas prices have stabilized, because gas prices, as you know, they've been going. They're like 60 cents a gallon higher than they were just a few months ago. So I support delaying that temporarily until gas prices have stabilized. I don't support a gas tax holiday because that money is needed for, you know, highway and bridge repair and all the rest for infrastructure. And we're just, you know, it's kind of a temporary gimmick. It probably wouldn't make a huge difference in the gas prices. And then when the gas price goes back on, when the tax goes back on, it would it could create an inflationary shock to the economy. So it's kind of a gimmick. I support a temporary delay in the cost of living adjustment, but beyond that, no holiday.
Any ideas about how, as governor, you would support small businesses?
Yes. When I was in the Clinton administration, I headed a program, as I described earlier, that funded about 1,000 small technology companies a year. $1 billion program around the United States to create new products and jobs, new technologies, products, and jobs. So I have a lot of experience in this area. One of the things that we would do as part of a climate policy, for instance, but we could do it in other areas as well. Maryland has enormous academic expertise in its universities, the University of Maryland system, all of the colleges and universities, Johns Hopkins and others. We can fund, working with those institutions, fund small technology companies that sometimes are partnered with those institutions to develop new technologies, it would be a partnership between the private sector, venture capital firms, and the government to fund early stage companies like this. That would be a way of tapping into the enormous resources that we have, all these smart people in the state with all of this expertise and these wonderful institutions, to leverage that to create small business entrepreneurship.
Okay. Well, Mr. Barron, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate your time. Good luck to you. Good luck to Natalie Williams as your running mate. And I'm sure that, as with all the candidates, we will see you at the polls in July. Thank you so much for your time, sir.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much for this opportunity. It was fun to speak with you.
Absolutely. That was John Barron, Democratic Maryland gubernatorial candidate. Again, thank you so much. That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, June 30th. Oh, we're in July, starting tomorrow, June 30th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.